It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, thank you for tuning in once again to the It's Going Down podcast. We're joined here today with Jasper. We're going to be talking about the California student occupation movement that grew in the late 2000s from about 2009 to 2010. We're going to be looking back at this period, comparing it to today, talking about just the crisis in education, linking it to the walkouts that are happening now, but also just talking not only about the actions, but a lot of the ideas that were surrounding this movement at the time, how it came to inform a lot of the other social movements and struggles that happened afterwards. So, Jasper, you just want to introduce yourself real quick?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jasper. I'm glad to be here. I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley from 2005 to 2012. So I was there in 2009, 2010, when everything was going down, and was involved in organizing and planning stuff that year.
Do you just want to talk a little bit about kind of how you ended up? We're going to be talking about the context of how this kind of arose, but just how did you end up in the middle of this student occupation movement?
It's hard to say, because in many ways it really fell on my lap. The crisis had been going on for about a year, year and a half, and things had gotten, increasingly worse for everyone around us. But the occupation movement was really, I think it was the first kind of mass organized response to the economic crisis. Really, people hadn't resisted in any kind of collective way up until then. This is before everything happened in Wisconsin, certainly long before Occupy. And I was waiting for something like that. I was waiting for people to kind of organize and respond. And I was kind of disappointed that they hadn't. I think part of that was because of the Obama phenomenon, and people were sort of invested in that in 2008. And I think in some way, Obama, he was able to kind of mute some of the anger and outrage and perhaps divert it. But then eventually, when the economic crisis turned into a fiscal crisis for the states, and particularly California, and they started to impose austerity on all kinds of public programs, that's when things started to happen. So, I and a number of my comrades were at UC Berkeley and other schools in the Bay Area. We knew that this massive 32% tuition increase was coming, was being proposed and coming down the line. And, we saw that was our opportunity to kind of do something about it and organize in a meaningful way, and not, simply in a kind of symbolic way. And we wanted to put these kinds of new tactics, or at least tactics that were for us new, back on the table. And we wanted to sort of do things like occupy buildings, which people really hadn't done in a long time, or hadn't done in any kind of real significant way in the U.S. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just, if we could just pause for a moment, the economic crisis in 2007, 2008, a lot of people listening to this, probably remember at least somewhat, that time. But if you can just take us back, overall, what did the crash do to the overall system, but also everyday people and in connection to public education. You mentioned there was going to be a 32% increase in tuition. I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. You know, I think it, you know, tuition was something like $8,000 back then, and it, you know, they did eventually pass that tuition increase, and it went, you know, immediately to I think $10,500 or $11,000 right away. And then there were a number of increases that followed thereafter. So that was massive. I mean, you know, it really changed the character of the University of California. I mean, it's a very different place now than it was back then. The class character of the UC has really changed. I think the student body is different. I mean, they think of themselves as consumers more and more. You know, it's not to say that there isn't still a lot of exciting things happening, but I, you know, it really did change things, and we had a sense that it was going to change things. People were hurting. You know, it was really hard to find a job. You know, I mean, everybody I knew who was, you know, just out of college was sort of having a hard time finding any decent work. And, you know, it was a grim time. And we also, there was a sense that it might get much worse, right? I mean, we didn't really know what was happening. You know, as it turned out, things were sort of stabilized, and things didn't get better, but they didn't get rapidly worse. But you know, at that time, it seemed like maybe things were, and then we were going to go into an even more serious kind of economic depression. So they were scary times for a lot of people.
Yeah, and it just had such a ripple effect. Like, you know, all of a sudden, like a bunch of construction wouldn't be happening. So all the construction workers would be laid off, and then they're not getting their T-shirts silk screened, and they're also not going out to eat all the time. So it just kind of had this rippling effect throughout society. You know, not only austerity, but just things shutting down, and just like you said, it was really hard to get a job. But just kind of like going back to the situation at the schools, for decades, college and student groups have been going to rallies and fighting for more money for education. Why did things get different this time around in 2009? Why did people start to take certain tactics maybe more seriously, or start thinking about taking things up a notch?
Well, I think there are two answers I could give. You know, one is that it was easy for people to see the connection between what was happening at, you know, UC Berkeley or the University of California system more broadly, and, you know, for lack of a better term, capitalism, right? They could see that there was this kind of economic system that had kind of swindled people and had kind of ruined the economy. And that was why things were bad for them. And that was why tuition was increasing. So it was very easy for people to kind of attach a narrative to their sense that something wasn't quite right. The other thing is that the people who ran the system, they made what seems to me to be a pretty serious miscalculation. They got the number wrong. You know, they raised tuition by 32%, and that was just too much for people. I mean, it really caused people to freak out. And ever since then, they've managed to keep it under two digits, right? The increases are always 8% or 9%, or, you know, if you do it like that, if you just slowly, you know, if you just slowly bleed people out year after year, you can sort of, I mean, you can manage not to provoke an uprising. But if you know, 32% was just too much. People were outraged. And, you know, at the same time, they were laying everyone off. So it did provoke a kind of uprising. And I think that, it was in some sense a miscalculation. Also, I think, you know, like I said, there were a lot of people who were looking for a place to intervene, right? There had been this big economic crisis, and there hadn't been a collective response. And I think a lot of people sensed that this was their opportunity. It wasn't just about education. It was about everything else. Those are probably the answers I could give.
Right. And in the case of like the Great Depression, it took years for people to actually start to see the wider system as kind of the problem and start to take more collective action. But you're right. This was kind of the first big thing that the people kind of rallied around and started to really kind of sink their teeth into. I'm just kind of curious if we could turn towards, you know, some of the ideas that were getting popularized at the time. This includes the ideas of the Invisible Committee with books like The Coming Insurrection, as well as the ideas centered around communization began to hold sway in certain parts of student worker occupation movement. Can you talk in general about just the concept and idea of communization and what did it have to offer the student movement?
Communization is in some ways a very esoteric term and, you know, something that I could spend a lot of time defining very precisely. And, you know, maybe that isn't necessary because people were using the term in a very loose way. And I think what they meant by it was that it was a kind of view of revolution and of kind of social action that emphasized immediacy, emphasized you know, sort of taking what you needed rather than asking for it. And it emphasized social rupture and collective action in a situation of breakdown, right? It gave a view of revolution or the passage beyond capitalism as occurring in a moment when, you know, capitalism begins to break down and people need to immediately kind of take over the homes and the workplaces and the spaces that they find around them and the machinery in order to meet their own needs instead of kind of, you know, petitioning the government to provide for them in some kind of way. And I think that was really appealing in that moment. It was appealing as a sense of what was going to be necessary, especially if you have the sense that things were only going to get worse, right? Especially if in some sense you agreed that the money wasn't there, that capitalism was broken in some way, and then in fact, you know, it wasn't going to be able to provide for people's needs, that they were going to have to provide for their own needs. They were going to have to just kind of take the things that they needed and wanted.
Yeah, I think one of the other key points is that in some currents of anarchist thought, there's this idea that we're just going to self-manage everything. Like, you know, we'll run basically society without the bosses. Whereas communization theory was kind of based on the idea that we're going to break down the separations and use things how we need them, as opposed to just kind of running society as it is now without, you know, the boss there or something like that.
Right. Absolutely. And that was, you know, that was a really important part of it. And I sort of made, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to articulate that particular aspect of communization and, you know, offer up a vision of revolution that emphasizes the impossibility of self-management and the impossibility of kind of using the machinery that we find in capitalism for the kinds of needs that we may have in communism. I think it's really important to know that we're going to have to kind of invent entirely new ways of doing things and new kind of systems for doing them. That was very appealing to me at that moment. Yeah, and you know, and there was a sense, I mean, just to make it specific to the university system, that, you know, we didn't really want to just preserve the university because we understood that the university was a sort of mechanism for perpetuating class society, right? But there was really no, I mean, that there were things that were excellent about the university. It was a place where we could, you know, go and learn and have access to all of these ideas. And that was certainly exciting. And we can meet other people and we could be, you know, spared the burden of, you know, having to work all the time. We'd just be working part-time or whatnot, or maybe we had a fellowship. And that part of it was great, but really, you know, what the university system was for was to, you know, to accredit certain people and to give them a leg up in the labor market, right? And allow them to kind of compete against other people so that certain people with university degrees would do better in the labor market and people without university degrees wouldn't. And, you know, that's what a university is for. It's about reproducing class. And, you know, it's ludicrous to just kind of imagine that the solution to that is to admit everybody into the university. Well, because then the university degree would be meaningless. It's only meaningful if it's something that you can use against other people who don't have a university degree. And it was really important to see that, you know, expanding access to the university wasn't the solution, that this was a part of a very rotten system, and that we didn't want to just take it over and self-manage it. We wanted to get rid of it and do something else with those buildings and those books. And
right. There's another slogan that's always kind of been around a lot of student movements is, you know, democratize the regents or the board of trustees or something like that, which right. Again, like seems like a radical demand that, you know, we want a seat at the board of power, but the most radical wing of the student occupation movement was saying like, no, we don't want, you know, a seat at the reading room of a prison. We want instead, you know, to turn this into something that's part of an actual liberated society and to use all this stuff and knowledge like to our own benefit as opposed to creating specialists in capitalism.
Yeah. And that was a very radical position. And it was a hard position to articulate at the time to other students, who were there because they did want a degree and they did want those benefits on the labor market, you know, understandably, right? People just want to kind of get by and they don't want to have to, you know, work a shitty job for the rest of their life. It was tricky to kind of, take that position.
Well, that kind of brings us to our next question is like, how did you kind of navigate that? Because like you said, I mean, you've got people going to, you know, university that, you know, their parents didn't go, they're there on debt, you know, they're trying to create a better life for themselves. And also they're fighting, you know, for their real class interests, you know, they're fighting over real bread and butter things. Also people were fighting to get, you know, janitors and service workers hired back. You know, they were fighting against rising costs. But at the same time, you know, there were these, you know, very real goals of, you know, kind of abolishing the university within class society. And there was a lot of, pointed fingers at the time of, you know, adventurous and such like that. So how did you kind of navigate, that, like you were saying, you know, kind of like the need for recognizing that these real bread and butter, things that people are fighting over are very real and tangible and good, but also these revolutionary aspirations.
Yeah, it was difficult. I don't think that we did a great job always with that, I have learned a lot in the intervening years, and I think I would approach that situation very differently now. I think that there was a real kind of vehement dismissal of all demands. The idea that kind of demanding something from the powers that be was in a way kind of strengthening them, or that it was a kind of subordination. And I guess I don't really have that perspective on demands now. I'm not going to go out of my way to articulate reformist demands. But at the same time, I think that there's no real way to get around them until you're at a kind of moment when people have truly transcended them and you're in then a kind of revolutionary situation. And there's no real way to kind of cheat that. And I think, you know, for better or worse, most of these movements we're a part of are reformist, and people, are acting in a way that implies that they want things to be reformed. And, you know, the student movement really was about it. You know, it was about fighting against the tuition increases and preserving access to the university. That's what it was in the broad sense. And that's okay. That allowed for all kinds of other things to happen and sort of and radical action. And what I've learned is that those sorts of demands and those positions are in many ways organic to these moments and to these movements. And, you know, you can be kind of moralist about it, but that's not really particularly helpful. And, what's interesting, right, is that people realize that in order to fight a 32% fee increase, they have to do these things that are crazy. right? Just to even win the smallest sort of forms, they have to take action that is almost kind of insurrectionary in its intensity. And that's the powerful thing about these moments, is that people, you know, they're encountering such resistance from the kind of ruling class that they're almost forced to become revolutionary, even as their aims are fundamentally still reformist. And so, you know, that's something I didn't know at the time, and I know now. It's something that we saw again and again, and in many of the movements that followed. Mm-hmm. I don't think we won anybody over to this kind of maxim. Well, some people, right? I mean, there was always this kind of small minority tendency that was interested in this kind of maximalist position, and that grew. But in the end, it was more about a learning process that was going to happen whether we were there or not, and that was what was interesting. And in some way, like whether people made demands or not, that's sort of a distraction.
Mm-hmm. And at some point there was basically, you know, there was a capitulation from the state. I remember governor at the time, Arnold Schwarzenegger, basically took money. It's almost like a similar situation with the West Virginia teacher strike. They took money, I think, out of that was going to go to healthcare for prisoners and basically moved it over to public education, if I'm correct.
He did. Yeah, he did. He basically, you know, stalled the attack on public education for a year or two, and he acknowledged the protests, mm-hmm. and he said that was part of changing his mind. You know, of course, at the same time, everybody else was getting cut, as you acknowledge, right? And you know, because the UC was the loudest, you know, the UC got hurt the least, but the community college the least. But the community college system, you know, got just incredibly savage during that period, right? And in some way, those are the students that are the most vulnerable and the poorest. It's complicated.
Yeah, I mean, just as you said before, I mean, it's not like these cuts haven't continued since then. I mean, it's just been a continuous onslaught. But I mean, you can see very clearly that this is, you know, they see it as a long process, but also very much so that they do all these things in mind that they're going to face some amount of resistance along the way. And, you know, when they encountered too much of it, they kind of scaled back a little bit just to kind of let off the pressure.
And like I said, they've never proposed an increase of more than 10% since then. Right. And they've also never, you know, faced a movement like that since then.
I believe that's what they call progressivism.
Right. And you know, now the context is so incredibly different. I mean, now I can't even imagine what it would be like to try to do the things that we were doing when at the same time you have to deal with, you know, fascist mm-hmm. Student groups on campus. A very different kind of student movement going on. But
right. And just as an aside, as you said, like the university has changed, like are the class interests so aligned at the university now that they would be, you know, so opposed to such a student movement.
Right.
But just to kind of go back into our timeline here, can you just talk a little bit about the spread of the student occupations in 2009? I feel like we're almost getting ahead of ourselves because these things kind of popped off and they kind of fed off of each other. And there was, you know, starting in places like Santa Cruz and then spreading to the Bay Area and then down to Southern California. I mean, they were happening all over the place. I'm just curious if you can just kind of talk about, just to kind of go back to that moment, how did this thing start and how did it spread? And also, what were people doing?
Yeah, it was really quite amazing. Like I said, we had this idea that the tactic that made sense for us at that moment was occupation. And that's because it was something that you could do that wasn't a demand. If you were actually taking what you needed at that moment, we weren't going to kind of ask for the university to be given back to us. We were just going to kind of take it. And of course, from there, people would and did levy demands. But we had the sense that, well, in every other country, when there's a student movement, they take over buildings and they like claim these these buildings as kind of liberated spaces, and they use them to organize. And that's what we needed to do. And for the most part, people hadn't been doing that in the United States. It wasn't a tactic that was really, you know, on the table for existing kind of student groups and student movements. And, you know, so a bunch of us really tried to kind of push this idea and, you know, occupied buildings and promoted the idea of occupying buildings. And it spread, you know, especially within the UC system. There was a kind of a revolutionary corridor that stretched from Davis to Santa Cruz through Berkeley and SF State. And, you know, there were multiple occupations at all of those schools, and, you know, all of them down the state and in Southern California as well, Irvine, UCLA. So it really, you know, it took off because we live in the moment where tactics can kind of go viral and they can spread through resonance and contagion, right? And I think because the tactic did make sense and people understood that it was a thing that you could do that was meaningful in that moment.
As an aside, I think one of the interesting things is there was two kind of occupations also that were sort of popularized. There was the, you know, the hard occupation where essentially people would lock themselves inside a building and they would, you know, barricade the doors. And like a lot of the iconic photos of UC Berkeley during the student movement, you see people in masks, you know, out the window with bullhorns and stuff. But then there were also open occupations where people would basically just hang out inside of a building and not leave and just kind of took it over that way. And and the idea was that people were invited in. And I think in like some places like Santa Cruz, like people were like taking over the copy machines and making copies of like the coming insurrection and showing films and stuff. And then of course there were like dance parties. I mean, there was a lot of things going on and kind of a sort of play with these spaces as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There were definitely the two models of occupation. And, you know, there's a sort of spectrum in between the two. There's the kind of open occupation and the closed occupation. You know, I think the closed occupation to some seemed more powerful, right? Because you excluded all of your enemies from the space and you really took it over. But at the same time, because you had to kind of barricade yourself in there, you weren't able to really use it, right? You were at that point under siege by the police. And oftentimes it was just very difficult to do that at a tactical level, just trying to kind of get in the space and control it is challenging. And so in many ways the open occupation made a lot more sense, right? But when you have an occupation that's kind of porous and people can come and go, your ability to use the space is compromised to some degree, maybe not. At Santa Cruz, like basically the authorities would just kind of sort of let people have these buildings, right? So the occupations would be open, but because the administration was afraid of kind of antagonizing the movements, they would just kind of let them do whatever they wanted. So they would be able to take over, you know, the main administration building and just, do whatever they wanted with it. I mean, it is incredible what... what they were able to kind of do in that context. In Berkeley, where the police are much more confrontational, that kind of thing wasn't possible. So things did sometimes go in the direction of the closed occupation. Mm-hmm. The great thing about the open occupation was you could use it as a kind of organizing space where people could come together and meet each other and that was really the idea, is that you would use that liberated area in order to prepare for the kind of the next moment.
Mm-hmm. And there was other kind of forms as well. I remember people were often pushing something like, occupy the library to keep it open during certain like studying hours, basically to extend the use of the space, under your own jurisdiction, basically. That was another popular tactic, but there was a lot of things like that.
There really are, a number of different variations. And, you know, and it really depends on what kind of building you're talking about. If it's a building that that students use for classes, the feeling of doing something there is very different than if it's an administration building, you know, where, you know, the people who are making decisions against you are doing their work. So it, yeah, really, you have to kind of take into consideration all of these, you know, different factors.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving forward in this period of, you know, occupations, things going on, there was certainly lots of meetings and people talking about how to organize themselves. What was the fights and kind of the dialogue like between the radical communizers, so to speak, and people we'll call leftists? And by that, I mean people on the left, people in Marxist-Leninist groups, nonprofits, people that kind of had a demand-based structure. And what does this say about the idea of left unity?
Well, it was different at each school. I think that the kind of ferocity of the moment took a lot of these existing left groups by surprise. And these groups, they tend to think of themselves as having a kind of monopoly on politics on campus, right? They sort of expect to be able to control any kind of movement, right? Because that's what they typically do. In normal years, they're able to kind of insert themselves into any kind of movement and take up leadership positions. But things were so intense and they were so big that their sort of monopoly was really disabled. And they just also didn't really have any real ideas. So it allowed for other kinds of possibilities. And the debates were pretty typical. I mean, I think that, you know, from the perspective of many of these groups, and, you know, there are, of course, different types of groups. You have student government, you know, who is very much involved in, you know, constant conversations and negotiations with the administration, and the administration treats them as if they were kind of partners. And they get really, you know, they get kind of really wrapped up in that, right? And they begin to really take themselves seriously, and they sort of think that they are, because they think that they are taken seriously. You know, and then there are the more kind of classical, you know, Trotskyist or Maoist groups on campus that are, you know, running a kind of ancient playbook. But those groups were pretty ineffective in that moment just because there were so many new people and there was so much happening. But, you know, the arguments were the arguments you would expect. Their claim was that you needed to be respectable in some way in order to, you know, appeal to, you know, the average student, right? That if you did these kinds of things, people wouldn't like you, right? And the important thing was to kind of win over hearts and minds. And it really wasn't about taking action. It was about persuasion. It was about convincing other people. And, you know, they had this idea that you were going to gather bodies until presumably at one point you'd be massive enough after you've convinced everybody to be on your side that you could then do something. But I think they really underestimated the appetite for action that people had. And, you know, they were sort of constantly running after events because people actually did want to, you know, engage in walkouts and strikes and occupations.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, there were also arguments about danger and vulnerability that the political violence, invited the police onto campus and put people at risk. Those were also kind of difficult conversations to have.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're familiar with all of these arguments.
Right. Right. I just think it's important to kind of go back, especially given today's context under Trump, where a lot of people kind of toe the line that, you know, if, you know, we're all on the same, we're all on the left, you know, on the same side, you know. But, you know, moving forward towards the end of 2009, the occupations ended, and there was kind of a push towards March 4th as kind of a day of action. Mm-hmm. And there was a decision that there was going to be like a large day of action across the state around March 4th. I'm just curious your thoughts about just that decision and kind of the push towards March 4th.
Yeah, that actually allows me to talk a little bit more about the last point. So, you know, those kinds of traditional student activists were to a certain extent displaced by the pace of events early on. But they did manage to assert themselves through a kind of control over the calendar. And what they did was they immediately began kind of planning future days of action, because of course you can never do things right now, right? Their response to everything is no, not now, later, right? So, you know, when the people that I was organizing with would, you know, propose that we needed to, you know, do something, you know, that day or right then, they would say, no, what we need to do is we need to build and organize for this thing that's later on. So in a way that they started to kind of set up these conferences and organizing bodies that would plan for kind of future days of action. And March 4th was the result of that to a certain extent. And, you know, I think eventually everybody kind of went around with it, because once it's, you know, once there's already a certain buy-in, you just kind of have to go with it. But it did end up, you know, one thing that happened is that we were constantly, you know, we were often kind of looking forward to this kind of future day of action, rather than trying to kind of, you know, look for opportunities, you know, at the places where we were. And, you know, ultimately that led to a kind of dissipation of energy. But I think ultimately things were going to dissipate one way or another anyway. But we did get attached to this kind of day of action model. So that there was, you know, when we came back, there'd been a lot of stuff that happened in the fall. There was, you know, the end of fall 2009 was an incredibly explosive moment. There were all these kinds of things that were happening. That was really the moment when there was a kind of occupation wave that went up and down the state, you know, especially around end of November, when the regents were meeting to decide on that 32% increase. At that moment, they passed the tuition increase, and then, you know, everybody went away for the winter break. And, you know, when everybody came back in January, instead of immediately kind of beginning where we were, people started to wait for this thing that was going to happen in March, right? And in some sense, that was the nail in the coffin, right? Because you needed to try to pick up the momentum as quickly as you could. Maybe in some sense, one of the problems with organizing on a university campus is that you always have these big breaks that come and interrupt anything you're doing. So in some ways, the fact that everybody, you know, went away for a month and there were no classes on campus, that might have been the problem. But in any case, we got stuck in this kind of calendar where we were, you know, waiting to do something rather than doing something. So yeah, and so in March 4th was also supposed to be an opportunity to organize with people in other parts of the K through 12 education system. And this was, you know, a kind of a noble vision, you know, which was that, like, in order to be effective, people in the UC system, they needed to connect to people in the Cal State University system, which is a kind of much poorer and more working class kind of part of California higher education, public higher education, community college system, and then, you know, K through 12 education, you know, and because all of these sectors were facing the same kind of austerity. And in many ways, the UC was the most privileged part of it. And it didn't, you know, those other sectors needed to be as, you know, as activated as people at UC, if not more activated. So, you know, so it was a noble idea to try to kind of move from just a UC-based model to one that really was, you know, across K-12 and higher education.
Right. And to some degree, that did happen. I mean, there were lots of walkouts. I mean, there were actions that happened at junior colleges and happened at CSUs. I mean, it wasn't like it did not spread. I mean, it definitely did. But I think there was also a fear much more within, the junior colleges and the CSUs. That's like, well, you know, as long as it kind of stays on the UC campus, you know, it's a little more manageable. Once it kind of gets into these more blue collar areas, then it's like we've really got something on our hands that we really want to stamp out.
And that's true. And that would have been like, you know, actually the really exciting moment if it had really taken off at the community colleges and the CSUs and the high schools. You know, then I think that, you know, I wish that that had happened. And that was the idea behind March 4th, is people were going to march from the Berkeley campus and march from the campuses, the other UC campuses, and try to connect with students from these other places.
Right.
So people marched from UC Berkeley into downtown Oakland, connected with high school students that had walked out, and community college students from Laney, et cetera. It was the right idea. It just, you know, may not have worked to the degree that people had hoped it would work.
Yeah, and plus the dynamic still is like, you know, we're all walking out to do this big march, which is, in theory, like, supposed to make people in power pay attention to you, like, you know, acquiesce to, like, some, like, large spectacle. Like, is that really how it works? As opposed to, you know, power being forced to concede something because the situation is uncontrollable and they've got to, like... make the pieces fit again. And this kind of brings us to our next question. You know, a friend once said, you know, on March 4th, you know, there was thousands and thousands of people that assembled outside of UC Berkeley and then went on a long march, as you said, all the way to Oakland, California. And it's interesting that instead of, you know, just turning and walking into the university and taking it over, which would have been much more exciting, people again kind of like went to these motions of, you know, long march from Berkeley to Oakland, which is a long march. And I'm just curious, you know, how that kind of happened and just kind of watching that unfold, whereas only a couple months ago, people were occupying buildings.
Well, I think it happened, you know, precisely because people on campus wanted to connect with these other sectors. And I think that, you know, the radical tendencies I was in dialogue with were pretty actually committed to that strategy. And the reason why is this. I mean, because there was a sense that there was no desire to really, to save the university, we really understood that the only hope we had was in igniting a kind of larger insurrectionary moment, right? It had to go beyond the university, or there was no real point to what we were doing, right? And so we, you know, everybody had this kind of hope that things were gonna take off, because we were sort of interested in taking over the university and using it as part of a kind of larger insurrectionary or revolutionary moment. There was this kind of hope that we could connect with these other education sectors, other parts of society. So that was, you know, that was the hope. You know, there were always two models about how you would do that. One is the model where you march off the campus and you go meet other people elsewhere. The other model is where you invite everyone else who isn't already a student or who doesn't have some role on campus to come onto campus and occupy, you know, campus. And, you know, I think both are good strategies. We just chose to do one on that day.
Right.
And that's the way it happened. And yeah, it was, you know, when you're in a moment like this, decisions are in a sense being made for you, right? That there was already going to be this major rally that was happening in Oakland that was being, you know, organized by people at Laney and the high schools. And, you know, our choice was sort of how to interface with that.
Well, I think that kind of brings us to our next question, is that, you know, many of the occupations kind of seem to rewrite the rules, so to speak. There were huge, you know, electric dance parties from occupied buildings where, you know, thousands of people were dancing around. You know, certainly doesn't happen at a lot of demonstrations. But how did this kind of shine a light onto what actually brings people into struggle?
Well, yeah, I think that was, you know, one of the reasons why people put forward occupation as a strategy, it has this positive dimension. It's providing you something very tangible right away, right? It gives you a space to kind of come together with other people. You have food there, you have things to do, you have events to sort of pay attention to or participate in. It's not about kind of asking for something that then will be given to you, you know, later on. It has this kind of immediate and positive dimension, and that was what was exciting about it. And, you know, I think that there was this really lovely emphasis on it being joyous as well. Sometimes, you know, it was maybe a little silly looking back, you know, with the kind of electro-communism, electro-dance parties. I mean, if you were to bring me back in time to one of those, occupation raves, it might seem a little dated, charming nonetheless, but a bit dated and sort of silly. But it was, you know, but the emphasis on fun and joy was really important. And right. I think, you know, that's a mark of a successful political moment, that people are enjoying themselves. Mm-hmm. Our response to austerity was not, you know, more austerity, but in fact to kind of propose, you know, joy and enjoyment. Santa Cruz, of course, being Santa Cruz, they were much better at it than us in Berkeley. They already have this kind of party school feel, and you know, they're in the woods, and so they were always able to kind of take it to the next level. Right. But you know, it was a really important part of that moment.
Yeah. And just to kind of like go forward into today's world, you know, there were people in the student occupation movement that did get in trouble, obviously, for breaking the law and taking part in these actions. But I'm just kind of curious, you know, this is something that we've asked other people about before. But when you compare people that are in the alt-right that have been caught, you know, engaging in whatever, and like there have been calls to expel them from campus, I'm just curious, when you think back at people that have gotten in trouble with the student occupation movement, how does that compare to today's world? It seems, because some people would say it's like, well, I know a lot of people that got in trouble for, you know, organizing with the student occupation movement, but if you're in there outright, it seems like you can do no wrong.
Right. I think that's probably correct. They tried to, you know, expel or sanction quite a number of people. They were unsuccessful, you know, partly because people resisted those processes. And very few people actually ended up with any real consequences, expulsions. I mean, there were a few cases, I think, at Santa Cruz maybe. At Berkeley, we mostly shut it down. And so, but that wasn't, you know, that wasn't because they didn't try. Whereas I think with the alt-right, they don't even try to sanction these people at all. And that's because the alt-right is interested in participating in the administration, right? It's like all the cops want is that you actually, you know, recognize their authority, right? If you do what these alt-right people do, and you sort of, you know, go up to the cops and say, yes, we like you, we want you to, like, you know, do security for this kind of event.
We want a permit.
Yeah, exactly. If you ask for a permit, they'll bend over backwards, you know, but of course you have to be willing to kind of, you know, it's the alt-right and the police, you know, they make a couple. In a way that, you know, a left student movement and the police don't. So, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, you know, the police on campus, they look at anti-fascist activists or, you know, kind of tuition protesters as much more dangerous. And they are, from their perspective, more dangerous because they're less willing to kind of work with the police. Mm-hmm. You know, they're more of a problem for them. They're more of a problem for their own authority and their own, you know, operations.
Mm-hmm. Well, one last kind of overarching question. You know, I think this is really important, but how did the student occupation movement in California go on to inspire Occupy and other movements? What was its lasting impact on the terrain of social revolt?
Well, I think that the impact was quite substantial. And this is something, you know, a lot of people have tried to point out. And there are a couple things I could point to. One is just to say, like I said before, that this is really the first significant kind of collective response to the economic crisis, right? Nothing else had really happened. Aside from like Republic Windows and Doors, kind of small responses, but no real kind of mass action. Another thing I'd point to is that, you know, on March 4th, when people marched down into Oakland to meet with the high school students and the community college students, they also did want to be effective in that moment. And so what people chose to do, rather than just stand around and have a rally, is to march onto the freeway, right, in order to kind of shut down traffic and blockade the freeway. And so they marched onto the freeway, about 200 people, and 150 people end up getting arrested on the freeway and shut down traffic for hours and hours and hours. The police took a bunch of people to jail. And afterwards, everybody was talking about what an incredibly stupid idea this was. It was seen as the most idiotic tactic. Why did you march on the freeway? Didn't you know you were going to be arrested? What possibly could you have hoped to accomplish, right? I've laughed at that so many times in recent years, because 4 years later, this would become the just the go-to tactic of the kind of Black Lives Matter moment. And that particular freeway that people marched onto, that particular on-ramp multiple times in Oakland in 2014, 2015. Right. So it seemed insane then, but now it's kind of, it's just what you do. And, in part it was effective later because the police realized that if you try to arrest everybody if you try to arrest hundreds of people on the freeway, you're going to end up shutting down traffic for a much longer period of time. So they kind of decided that instead of trying to do a big mass arrest on the freeway, they just kind of try to shoo people off, right? Or just wait till people walk off themselves. So it's right. Now easier to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of tactical legacy. The other thing is that I think in many ways, and you can see this by sort of reading some early kind of writings about Occupy Wall Street, is that Occupy Wall Street was influenced by the occupation movement in California. The kind of people who were putting it together in the beginning, they took these slogans and these ideas, Occupy Everything, from the student movement and from this idea that, instead of just asking for things, we needed to kind of take space for ourselves, began to organize directly. So, obviously there are many other influences on the Occupy movement. It was, primarily, influenced by this kind of, movement of the squares thing that was happening in Europe and Tahrir Square and all these kinds of things. But I do think that the particular, regional language of Occupy was something that can be traced back to the California student movement. So it was a part of the story.
Well, just in closing, is there any text or anything to read that you would encourage people to check out if they're interested in following through in any of these ideas or history?
Well, there was a really great zine or newspaper that people put together about the California student occupation movement called After the Fall. It collects a lot of the communiques and documents that people wrote and, does a fairly good job at kind of contextualizing things. So it's called After the Fall. And I think, it's available as a PDF online. Mm-hmm. Easy to find.
We'll definitely link to that in the show notes for this.
Yeah, and you can, there was a kind of communique that a bunch of people who were at some of the UC schools wrote during this kind of occupation wave called communique from absent future. And those people, Research and Destroy, who are still around, have written a number of texts since, you know, since that moment. So they might be worth checking out as well.
Anything else you want to talk about, or in closing, anything else you want to say? Just curious kind of where this line of thinking takes us now, just looking forward. I mean, in the time where Betsy DeVos, you know, rules over public education, and also just, you know, today as we're recording this is the day that there were walkouts across the country in response to the Parkland shooting. So I'm just kind of curious, this kind of spirit, do you see it living on? How does it inform what's happening today?
That's a great question. I'm still trying to figure out the moment that we live in. You know, the last 2 years have been so weird. And in some ways, it just seems completely different. You know, the kind of post-Trump era seems like just such a radical break with the things that came before. And yet, you know, there are these continuities. And so, yeah, you know, I think that, you know, the tactic of occupation is still, you know, it's still, I think, pertinent. I think it's still one of the kind of main weapons that people have, and we're going to see more of it. So I think it's certainly good to kind of remember what people did. It's, you know, I keep thinking about how different campuses are these days, now that they've become these kind of battlegrounds between, you know, fascist student groups or, you know, fascist speakers who don't have any connection to campus but just want to kind of do things there, and protesters. It's a very different dynamic, because it's a kind of three-way dynamic where you have to, you know, you have to deal with the fascists and the administration and the police, you know. And in some ways it felt, you know, by comparison, it was so much simpler to do things on campus when we were doing them, right? I mean, the complexity of these kinds of situations that people encounter now, it's strange, and it's, you know, it's hard to know how to maneuver around them.
It's great that people are putting so much work into that, and it's good also to look back at everything that happened in this period and use it to.
It's clear that, I mean, just in the last week, this kind of wave of resistance that, in some ways, it starts in different places. You could trace it back to kind of Sacramento. Mm-hmm. When people confronted the Nazis there, but you could also say that it kind of starts with the kind of Milo shutdown at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that strategy has completely won, right? I mean, Richard Spencer is destroyed. He's you know, calling off his college tour. You know, Matthew Heinbach and the TWP are done. You know, and it's largely because they've been confronted, you know, in these places, and particularly their attempt to kind of to infiltrate the universities has been, you know, shut down.
Right.
So, you know, it's cool that people have resisted them despite the naysayers.
Yeah. And just on that note, I think the final irony is that, you know, Richard Spencer is always saying, like, you know, what they're trying to do is rewrite the rules of, you know, the state of exception and, you know, take control of the state and all that, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I've read Adorno once, you know, I'm cool. But, you know, in reality, the only group of people that's forced people to kind of rethink, you know, violence outside of the state that is acceptable is anti-fascists.
Right.
I mean, they're the only people that really have galvanized a huge segment of the population to be like, actually, the state isn't doing anything about the growth of a fascist movement. And I think that self-defense and beating these people back is actually a really good thing. And I think that's, to me, I think that's the final irony that's just so sweet, is that ultimately their project not only failed, but I think in many ways we succeeded in making, I mean, if you just compare like the amount of people that were excited and came out to see, for instance, like Mark Bray on his speaking tour, compared to like the, what, like 3 dozen people that came to see Richard Spencer. I mean, you know, it's just like, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, they're sort of back. I mean, there's a moment where they did really seem like they had the initiative and they had the upper hand. I mean, especially here in the Bay Area, last April, when these Nazis were all coming to Berkeley, it was a dark time, because they really had the initiative and they seemed like they were, had the power to mobilize a ton of people, and it was scary. But now they're back to being the nobodies that they're destined to be. So that's great. Now we can focus on other kinds of
Yeah, and that's really important too, is like recognizing that victory and then, moving beyond it, because there's a lot of other shit we got to do beyond punching.
Yeah, and one of these sooner or later, the economy is gonna go into the dirt again.
Mm-hmm.
It's already in the dirt for a lot of people, right? For whom things have never gotten better. But we're gonna go into another recession, and it's unclear how bad it's gonna be. But because of the kinds of because of the situation we have, because things never really got better for a lot of people, and because the debt overhang is still really high in these places, it's gonna be intense.
Mm-hmm.
And market is so fucked and so overblown. So, that's gonna be the interesting moment, is when the recession happens on Trump's watch.
Yeah. I was reading the other day that, like, the way that tech capital and kind of the stocks and everything look is exactly how it did before the dot-com bubble burst.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are – I mean, people have been saying this for a while, but they're saying that it is.
Yeah, they have been saying it for a long time.
Right. And you also study this stuff a lot. I mean, do you see a coming tech bubble bursting anytime soon?
I really don't know. I thought it would have come here. I thought it would have been here already. This has been a remarkably long. I mean, I think historically one of the kind of longest quote unquote expansions of the entire post-war U.S. economy. It's been so long because it's been so weak and so shallow. The growth rate has been, pretty low. But there's still been some growth. And, I didn't think that it would have gone on this long. So I don't really know. I mean, sooner or later, there will be a recession, and it could be quite bad. It could be a depression again. It's hard for me to say exactly when, because there are some elements that I just don't fully understand. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Obviously the stock market is really, really overvalued. At the same time, it doesn't seem to be regular people's money that's bound up in it. And so that's very different than the 2007 crash, right? Because mm-hmm. it's not like it's just, working class people that got a variable rate loan, right? And suddenly then they can't pay it. It's different, right? The money in the housing market is just all rich people's money now, right?
Right.
So,
it could be just a continued race to the bottom. I mean, if you read Forbes, if you look at all these economic forecasts, it's saying, 10, 15 years from now, 25 to 40% of jobs will be displaced by automation. 50% of the workforce will be doing some sort of freelance work. I mean, it's really shitty, incredible stuff that they're talking about, which is going to leave no one in a better position. It's just going to continue to degrade and ground people down to the very bottom. And, regardless if there's a recession or not, I mean, people are going to be really fucked.
People are going to be really fucked, and that's where people are going to have to kind of look back at the things people were doing in 2010 and 2012, mm-hmm. Which lacked responses to economic crisis. And, the last few years, their politics has been about other things to some extent. But I think we're gonna get back to that moment sooner or later.
Yeah, I just wonder, like you were saying, like now with tuition increases, there's kind of like, you know, the lobster in the pot where the water slowly boils, doesn't feel that it's dying. Like, is that gonna be us? Just like, you know, all these things, the economy, global warming, is that just gonna be us kind of like slowly not feeling it get worse and worse? Like, would it almost be better if there was like a depression type situation, just so people would be kind of forced to deal with the reality? Because as it seems now, it just, things are slowly eking up a notch. And I think people are just kind of waiting for a spark. I mean, like, even looking back on the Trump moment, I think what's interesting about this time in terms of like social struggle is that we haven't seen like the eruption of an Occupy or Black Lives Matter that kind of like forces everything to kind of like, you know, through its vortex or something like that. You know, we're seeing like intense struggles break out all over, and like kind of like small, you know, fights over a pipeline, you know, fights against Richard Spencer, you know, the West Virginia teacher strike, like really big important stuff, but something kind of not on the national scale. Yeah, and like, but it also feels like something like that could break out literally at any moment. Like when Heather Heyer was killed, it was just like thousands of people in the street that night.
Right. The Trump moment did seem like it was going to be something, but he's so bad at doing all the things he wants to do that I think people, you know, a lot of the people who are getting ready to kind of throw down, realize that he wasn't going to be as effective of a fascist as he wanted to be, you know, or that at least the fascist wing of his administration didn't really have their shit together, right? And that it was just going to be like, you know, Bush 2.0. And it really changed, right? I think that the mood in February of, last year was very different than the mood in May. Right. People were terrified in February. Right. They didn't know if like we were going to, you know, be in kind of civil war or something like that. And, you know, but then by May, people, you know, thought, well, OK, he's clearly not going to be able to do all the things that he wants to do.
Yeah. Do you have any, I mean, this just for shits and giggles, do you have any predictions? Do you think Trump is going to win in 2020?
I really have no idea. I have no idea. I think I'd go either way. I think probably not. Mm-hmm. I think probably not. I think probably he loses. But I didn't think he was going to win either. So, you know,
sure.
Like most people, I was completely, you know, I was one of the 95% of people who had, you know, who just thought there's no way he wins. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats, they continue to, they continue to amaze me at just how bad they are at their job.
Right.
You know, they're so terrible. They're such clowns. And, I'm not interested in trying to make them more effective, but, you know, they're complete cluelessness.
Mm-hmm. Refusal to do anything other than drift to the right.
So, you know, maybe if they end up running somebody like Kamala Harris, you know, if they run some like neoliberal shill, you know, and they think they can, you know, they think they can kind of appeal to people with smoke and mirrors. Who knows? Anything's possible, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the other wild card too.
If they ran on, you know, even just the tiniest bit of substance, I think they should roundly, you know, wipe the floor with Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the other wild card too. I was saying is, you know, will they be able to capture people's attention in the midterms in such a way that pacifies people? Because right now it seems like people are running to the polls just because they're freaked out and they're like, we got to get, you know, we don't want Roy Moore or Trump coming in. We've got to like just vote somebody else in. But it remains to be seen if that will kind of like pacify people. It just seems like things are breaking down to the point where it doesn't matter who's in office. And, you know, that's the truth.
Yeah.
It's not going to matter who's in office because, you know, this, you know, government is managing the disaster. It's not, you know, saving it from itself. All right. Thank you for Jasper for joining us on the It's Going Down podcast. We hope you enjoyed that discussion. And we hope that some of the stuff we were talking about helps us think critically about the period in time that we're in with massive student walkouts. There's going to be demonstrations this weekend. There are posts on It's Going Down if you're looking for handbills and stuff to hand out at March for Our Lives demonstrations and walkouts that are critical of gun control, critical of state solutions, critical of the Democratic Party that are pushing for a self-organized and direct action centered approach. So go to itsgoingdown.org, check out some of the recent posts. Crime Think and also other people have zines, pamphlets, handbills, flyers you can hand out, PDFs you can print out and click on, and stuff that you can use to interact with people to have a conversation. And thanks again for listening. Please, 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 if you enjoy It's Going Down, we are in a period of building again. If you can, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Sign up to donate monthly if you can, or give us a one-time donation. And we're celebrating a year and a half of the It's Going Down podcast. We hope you enjoyed this discussion. We'll see you next time.